Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Before I dive into the particulars of this week's podcast, I have several announcements. First, my apologies for not penning a fresh revelation this week. My schedule was compressed to the point I just couldn't manage the feat. I'll try to do better next week. Second, one reason I ran out of time was I devoted 2 days to MasterFit University boot fit training, which I always find immensely edifying. Their methodology is sound and grounded in reality as opposed to an ideology. I can't say enough about the quality of the faculty. The experience level is off the charts. It's impossible not to learn something in every session. By the way, the people who create and promulgate MasterFit U is the same crew whose boot reviews RealSkiers.com has always linked to. It is unquestionably the most authoritative source on the subject of alpine boots. The fact that they are without peer is evinced by the cooperation of every boot brand in their annual boot test, most of whom send their top boot mavens to the test. They are the gold standard. My third and final public announcement is about the RealSkiers.com find function. I've invited shops on Jackson's List to send me the names of the models they're stocking this year. The lists are trickling in gradually, and when I have enough critical mass, I'll connect their inventories to my recommended ski reviews. So much for the news. Now, on to the past. Today's podcast is one of the early episodes of The Making of a Skier, my autobiographical history in the sport that has been gradually spooled out over the course of several seasons. Today's selection is Chapter 4, Solomon Field Days, in which I quickly sketch my experiences as a freshly anointed Solomon Education Services representative, a rung so low on the employment ladder they had to create a new bottom rung just for me. For those of my dear listeners who would rather read than listen, this chapter of The Making of a Skier can be found among the RealSkiers.com archived revelations on our members' site. Remember, becoming a RealSkiers.com member costs only $24.95 for a full year, and renewals are only $19.95. Donations are also ultra gratefully accepted. Please be advised, dear listeners, that the stories you are about to hear are just a small sample of the shenanigans that went on during my brief career in the field. I will most likely mine this vein again. And now, The Making of a Skier, Part 4, Solomon Field Days. I was an experiment. Clay Freeman, Solomon's Western sales manager, and Tom Corlett, the Colorado Front Range rep who would soon assume Freeman's mantle, met me in the United Airlines lounge at Stapleton Airport to offer the newly created position of service representative. I was hired at the princely sum of $9,600 per annum to support 3 sales territories by performing all their binding certification clinics, thereby freeing the associated salesman to extract yet another round of orders from Solomon's vast dealer network. In those sepia-tinged days, binding certification took 4 hours, including a written exam and lab session. I presented around 57 such seminars the first year in Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico. When I wasn't doing day-long back-to-back training sessions, I was expected to pop in on unsuspecting dealers and perform shop inspections to be sure standards were being maintained. It turned out this, too, was experimental, as I was the only rep in the country to ever perform a single shop inspection, much less inform an established retailer that he had failed and was no longer certified. I'm going to digress from the established text, if I may, dear listeners, because there's more behind this particular story. So I went to see a shop called Jerry's, which I believe was in the southern end of Salt Lake City at the time, and I found the most deplorable conditions you could imagine in the back. Skis were literally stacked like hay in parts of their shop area, awaiting their non-inspection or mounting, or I don't know, maybe just their death. But their standards, needless to say, did not measure up. So I failed them innocently, thinking, well, this is just the system working as it should. Well, the retailer responded to Solomon's complaint that the reason we had done this heinous act by cutting him off from, you know, part of his commercial lifeblood was that he was underselling Sunset and Wolf's, who were the two dominant chains in Salt Lake at that time. That was not the point. The point was that he had fact was physically and objectively dangerous to his customer base, but he had found, or his lawyers had found, a very sensitive point, which is that we were trying to enforce a price on the marketplace, which the Federal Trade Commission looked askance at, and Solomon ended up having to sign a consent decree. Not just the brand, but every single Field Force member had to sign an FTC consent decree for every year that this was enforced, agreeing that we were in no way, shape, or form going to try to enforce a particular pricing policy on our dealer network, and extended to the point where when we started to introduce the SX91 ski boot, which everybody wanted, rather than create some sort of legal contretemps with every single dealer, reps were given a card on which they were supposed to recite a very dry, lawyer-like bit of disclaimer about the fact that we appreciate your interest in Solomon, but we're not going to extend to you the possibility of becoming a Solomon dealer. I won't get into what a big deal that was at the time, but suffice it to say there was all sorts of hair on fire discussions, and if you chased them all the way back up to their point of origin, it was Jackson knocking at the door innocently of Jerry's Sporting Goods and saying, "May I see your back shop?" I will now return you to our regularly scheduled program. And so it was that in the late fall of 1979, I found myself standing inside the doorway of Zermatt House, the names have been changed to protect the guilty, in a banlieue of Salt Lake City, staring at an archival ski poster that was so sun-faded, it was as if someone had only colored one corner of it. No one appeared to greet me, so I sauntered up the nearby staircase to the second floor. Somewhere on that stairwell, I passed through an invisible membrane and into the twilight zone of shop visits. Most ski shops are so overstuffed with merchandise it's hard to identify an aisle, but Zermatt House looked like it had been evacuated by a bomb scare several years earlier and never repopulated. The sweaters on hangers had dust epaulettes draping their shoulders. I feared to pick up the folded ones lest they disintegrate under my touch. I was contemplating the waves of dead flies littering the windowsills and wondering if they had gone mad trying to escape this asylum when the proprietor, Rudy Spitz, again name changed to protect the innocent, suddenly popped into the room. Short, slight, and slightly suspicious of me, Rudy immediately warmed up when he learned I was from Solomon. Rudy excitedly related how he and Georges Salomon became great pals when the Solomon patriarch had visited his shop in the early 1970s. Now that we were buddies, Rudy couldn't wait to demonstrate the cutting-edge marketing that was synonymous with Zermatt House. First stop was the Rudy Spitz Ski School, which I hadn't noticed was on the floor right next to me. Arrayed on the ground at the head of a phalanx of folding chairs was the top of a clock dial, designated by the numbers 9 through 3 on squares of cardboard. Rudy walked to the head of this arrangement and revealed to me the secrets of the Rudy Spitz Ski School. He stood on what was clearly the maestro's cardboard square and demonstrated. "You see," he said in his heavily accented English, "I stand here and I show them how it's done." He assumed a crouch with bent elbows and knees and began to swivel his cardboard 90 degrees to the left and 90 degrees to the right. He lit up as if the room were once again full of eager students. "I have taught thousands of people to ski right here," he exulted. I thought to myself, I found the weak link in our system, the leak through which all of our promotional air has escaped. No wonder our sport can't hold on to new recruits. One session with Rudy and you'll decide to hibernate the entire winter and may not come out in spring. My reverie was interrupted by Rudy tugging me by the sleeve. "Time to see the workshop. I can't wait." We descend two floors, in the process activating the Zermatt House time shift. Sure enough, Rudy's shop was caught in a time warp in which every Solomon binding he owned had ceased to be indemnified as soon as we had a list we could drop them from. Rudy was baffled how dealers were selling new bindings for less than what he had paid for his during the Nixon administration. I muttered something to the effect that life was, indeed, a mystery. Our mood was somber as we trudged back up to the first floor, when doors connecting the shop to the Spitz living quarters practically burst off their hinges, battered out of the way by Beth Spitz, Rudy's wife. Following a code that must be buried deep within the pineal gland, Rudy's mate was at least twice his size and looked capable of absorbing his entire body, like a black hole, should he stray too close. I believe Beth was intent upon offering refreshments when Angels intervened in the guise of a young couple who had quietly entered the vestibule, eyes bright with a mix of enthusiasm and perplexity. I imagined they were answering an ad for the Rudy Spitz Ski School. We'll never know exactly what they wanted, as Rudy decided he needed a photograph to document this historic occasion almost as much as Beth needed refreshments. From somewhere the rudiments of a camera, one notch above the disposable kind, was procured and thrust into the hands of the startled young wife, with instructions to take a photo of the group, then pass the camera along to the next person who would do the same, etc. The ideal vantage point turned out to be from the middle of the street in front of the shop. This made as much sense as anything else that had happened in the last hour. The camera and its various subjects were in mid-rotation when the husband and I ended up in the middle of the street. He leaned into me and, as if we were co-conspirators, asked if any of this were normal. I reassured him that everything was as weird as it could possibly be, and that if he valued his future life, he should bolt while I created a distraction. I think all I did was remind Beth about some promise of cookies, and the spell of impromptu photography was broken. The couple dashed for their car. Beth beelined for the cookie jar, and Rudy reminded me to tell Georges hi for him. No problem, I said, adding I still had another shop to see, although how could it compare with the European flair of Zermatt House? When I visited Rudy and Beth in 1979, Solomon had roughly 2,800 binding outlets. The experiment called Jackson Hogan Service Representative was deemed necessary because sales reps couldn't possibly visit all their far-flung accounts and still nurture the majors who underpinned the whole business. Today, roughly 2,000 of that number are gone. The independent urban specialty retailer is more endangered than the black rhino. Few save their lessors will lament the passing of the many chain locations that have been shuttered. But we've also lost a great many more that were like Zermatt House, unicorns that seemed like they couldn't have been real. Their owners were evangelists of the sport, investing all they had and all they were in teaching skiers, one by one, to swivel their feet from 9 o'clock to 3. This has been Jackson Hogan for Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Thanks for listening.